is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's National Nap Day. Well, or it should be. Today, you know, it's the day after daylight savings time. First of all, why don't they do it on Friday night so that you get the weekend to acclimate to it? Secondly, why do we do it at all? Daylight savings time went into place in 1917, as we were going into World War I, and it was to save electricity, to save coal, because we needed it for the war effort. And, we don't need it for the war effort anymore. There is no World War I going on. So why, I don't know. Anyhow, my body still thinks it's 8 o'clock in the morning, even though I was in Minneapolis over the weekend. But I still, I kind of live on Eastern Standard Time. Louise and I get up at 5 every morning, between 4 and 5, and we got to do show prep and stuff like that. And that's Pacific Time, which is, 7 to 8 a.m. Eastern Time, which is but daylight savings time, for some reason, hits me hard. Do you know of any efforts, because I would love to sign on to one, to do away with daylight savings time? One of the things that we know from epidemiology, from studies, looking at car accidents, more people die in car accidents on Monday mornings than any other day of the week. Because during the weekend, people stay up late, sleep in the morning, and their body clock gets out of sync. We're always, in fact, the studies, we're always trying to have a 25-hour day. The studies that have done where they put people in caves and things or in light-proof places and not given them access to clocks for a period of days, they find that your body will normally regulate around 25 hours rather than 24 hours a day. No idea why, but, that's the case. And so we're constantly fighting jet lag, as it were. Why this? So anyhow, there's this National Nap Day. Let's turn the Monday after daylight savings time. If we must have daylight savings time, let's turn that Monday after it into a holiday. Over the weekend, Alternet put up this article that I wrote. I mentioned it last Friday, but I wanted to dig into it a little more on trade. The old joke about even a stopped clock, a broken clock, is right twice a day. Donald Trump is promoting tariffs. In the election in Pennsylvania, for example, Connor Lamb, the Democrat, is supportive of tariffs. I am supportive of tariffs. Most of the Democrats I know are supportive of tariffs. I was, I flipped on MSNBC this morning and heard Ali Velshi say, Connor Lamb is contradicting his own party. As far as I know, most people in the Democratic Party are in favor of protectionist trade policies, frankly, and not just tariffs. But I'm not sure what the official position of the party is. Perhaps we'll find out later in the week. We can ask Congressman Pocan about that. But I know the progressives, Bernie's been on this program for years, right? For 11 years he was on this program calling for tariffs. Progressives generally support some sort of protectionist policies that bring our jobs back home. So, I published this article. It's titled, "Democrats Should Steal Trump's Thunder on Trade." It's over at alternet.org. And I started out with this quote from Adam Smith from Wealth of Nations in 1776, his famous book. It's the only reference in the entire book to the phrase "the invisible hand." Everybody talking about the invisible hand of the marketplace, right? Well, the first 11 words of that famous sentence are almost always omitted. So the way that people quote Adam Smith, omitting words, is they say, the entrepreneur intends, or he intends, only his own security, and by directing that industry in such a manner as its produce may be of greatest value, he intends only his own gain, and he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end that was no part of his intention. But the part that is almost always removed from that is by preferring the support of domestic to that of foreign industry. In other words, Adam Smith was saying the invisible hand of the marketplace works when people prefer to buy things made, well, in his case, it would be made in England. In our case, it would be made in the United States. We Democrats should be taking this issue and saying, Donald Trump, great, you know, tariffs on steel and aluminum, but don't stop there. Let's you know, right across the board, let's equalize. You know, the way that I tell this, I've been telling this story for years and years. I mean, the way that I characterize this is that if you can make a pair of shoes in Connecticut with a dollar's worth of labor, and you can make that same pair of shoes in Mexico with 50 cents worth of labor, or in China with 20 cents worth of labor, then when you import shoes from Mexico, you should add a 50 cent tax. And if you import shoes from China, you should add an 80 cent tax. So the cost of labor ends up being a dollar wherever you make the shoes, so you might as well make them here. It's easier to ship directly to your customers and things like that. And that's, and this, you know, Alexander Hamilton came up with this in 1791. It was largely passed by 1793 at the request of President Washington. And it worked. It built America into an extraordinary industrial economy. And it worked right up until the 80s. And Reagan started taking this apart, you know, Reagan and Thatcher, the whole neoliberal thing, and let's do away with, and then the DLC and Bill Clinton in 92 running on NAFTA, running on a campaign of eliminating tariffs, in that case specifically for Mexico and Canada, but then broadly, you know, all these other, we've got deal after deal after deal to the point that we've got no tariffs left. And there's some great comments on this article. This is a quote I didn't even know about, and I love it. I haven't been able to verify if it's an actual Abraham Lincoln quote or not, but somebody posted it in the comments, and whether it's an absolute Lincoln quote or not, this is the quote. It's still a great quote. When an American paid $20 for steel to an English manufacturer, Abe Lincoln is said to have had, when an American paid $20 for steel to an English manufacturer, America had the steel, and England had the $20. But when he paid $20 for steel to an American manufacturer, America had both the steel and the $20. I mean, look around you right now. I defy you to identify more than one or two things in your home that, or place of business, wherever you may happen to be, or in your car, that were actually made in America. We really need to be bringing back this, another comment. I worked 30 years, plus years, in manufacturing in the aerospace industry. We've lost overall as a result of these so-called free trade deals, somewhere around 5 million manufacturing jobs. By the way, I would add, NAFTA estimated, the trade agreement itself estimated that it was going to cost us 1 million jobs. It's part of the deal. There's Congress allocated money to train people for new jobs who were going to lose their jobs as a result of NAFTA. It's like, we knew this going in. And we're going to train them for what kind of jobs? This is something we really need to be focusing on. Another person commented, said, along with tariffs, we should bring back truly progressive individual income and corporate tax rates, like 65% on people earning over $1 million from any source. Also tax companies with over $500 million in gross revenues at 50% rates. We should reinstate the alternative minimum tax laws, as well as requiring corporations to bring back to the United States those trillions offshore in tax havens. We should eliminate the cap on Social Security so we have a true Social Security system. Another person talks about how, you know, the Dow is at 25,000 and we're making nothing. How can that be a reflection of our economy? It's not. It's a reflection of, you know, people moving money around. So, you know, your thoughts on trade, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
A bunch of other news that we're going to get to as we go through the program today, but stick around. And welcome back. Let's see here. Andrew, watching Free Speech TV on a Roku box in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Andrew, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
About the new tariffs that Donald Trump has put on for aluminum and steel, No, I don't think it's going to have a beneficial effect. I also don't think it's going to create any jobs. I definitely don't believe that, you know, the old 1950s and 60s steel mills are going to reappear and, you know, all will be well. You know, I just think that's a false reality.
I don't entirely disagree. I do, however, know that the neoliberal trade policies that started in a big way under the Reagan administration and were put on steroids when GATT became NAFTA and the WTO during the Clinton administration, that those things have devastated the American working class and built the Chinese middle class. We took China from being, probably in the, 100 down to being the number one or number two in terms of economic power in the world by shipping our jobs to China. And we've got to figure out a way to get our stuff back, you know, making things back in the United States. This is a national security issue. We can't make a cruise missile without chips from China. And we might go to war with China. You know, we can't build tanks without steel that we don't make here in the United States any longer.
Actually, we do still make steel here.
It's just not enough.
We don't employ that many people to do it anymore.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's true.
The same thing is in China. You know, they're not employing. I mean, a lot of steel companies probably, you could say, are there, but they're not employing, a whole bunch of workforce for it. They're, of course, doing it through automation.
Instead of having three people per ton produced, they're down to one person per ton produced. But still, somebody has to build the steel mill. Somebody has to run the steel mill. Somebody's marketing it. The profits from the steel. All of those things should be within the United States. I'm in favor of a tariff-based trade system. I'm in favor of America, of an America-first trade policy. And just because Donald Trump campaigned on it and won on it, and by the way, the majority of Americans are in favor of this, doesn't mean that we should throw it out. Progressive Democrats have been in favor of tariff-based trade policies ever since, the big schism in the Democratic Party happened in 1992 when Bill Clinton came out in favor of NAFTA and Ross Perot, who had previously been a Democrat,
Republican.
Yeah, okay. That makes more sense that he was a Republican. But anyhow, Ross Perot started, his reform party, that we're gonna fight back against this. And he got 20% of the vote just based on that. Progressive Democrats since the 90s have been opposed to the DLC policies, the neoliberal policies that Bill Clinton was promoting. And I'm with them. I mean, to this day, the Progressive Caucus, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, has been supporting tariffs forever. I mean,
but Tom, why not fight China on intellectual property, which is a huge concern nowadays? I mean, this tariff is not going to affect them. It won't do anything to them whatsoever.
Well, marginally. We represent about 3% of their steel exports. And intellectual property is a whole completely separate issue. But can be subject to tariff provisions as well. And yeah, we're getting ripped off, particularly in China. But, I think that we need manufacturing is how a nation creates wealth. It's not service economies, it's manufacturing economies. Andrew, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. So a few other things going on here in the news that I wanted to mention. Well, there's a lot. We've got 3 hours here. We'll get through a lot of it. But this, every now and then you just kind of see things that are like signs of the times. And I don't mean that as a pun because this is about a billboard. But it tells me that there is a sentiment changing in this country. And it's changing around guns. And it's changing as a consequence of student activism. These kids from the Parkland High School, they're amazing. The March for Our Lives that is coming up in Washington, D.C. and in cities all over America, they are organizing this thing. They're using social media. It's just remarkable. And in Louisville, Kentucky, there was a gun show coming to town, or there is. And the billboard, somebody put up a billboard. It's going to be at the Kentucky Exposition Center at the end of, this is the end of February, so this March. I don't know. This must have been a week. Well, this story, though, is dated to yesterday. Yeah. Okay. So the story is dated yesterday. So the billboard says National Gun Day Gun Show. Okay. And somebody hung 17 or hanged, whatever the correct use of the word, 17 white crosses from the billboard. And each cross has the name of one of the 17 kids who was murdered in Parkland at Marjorie Douglas Stoneman, isn't it? Stoneman Douglas High School, yeah. Anyhow, so, you know, when you see these kind of things, you go, wow, you know, things actually are changing. I mean, there is something going on. So, and I want to get into the race in Pennsylvania, what's happening there too, but we'll do that in just a few minutes. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Paul in Oakland, California, you wanted to talk about daylight savings time?
Yeah, hi, Tom. So here in California, we have a ballot initiative. I think it's going to be on the November ballot to opt out of daylight savings time.
Whoa!
So us plebs will get to decide that issue here.
Yeah, that is great. I'd love to see a ballot issue like that here in Oregon too. It's just go ahead.
I'm thinking that, you know, we're such a big economy, our neighbors are going to have to come along eventually, because for 7 months of the year, you guys would be on a different time zone than us.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. And
Oregon, Washington, and Nevada.
Well, and if a state as large as California does it, that's the kind of thing that might stimulate a national. I mean, this is something that Congress needs to take up. The law was passed by Congress in 1917, and, you know, to save coal, and it's unnecessary.
States like Arizona and Hawaii opt out because they have enough sunshine. You know, they need cooling hours. They don't need daylight hours.
So those Hawaii and Arizona have already opted out. I knew that there was one state. I didn't realize there were two that had already opted out of daylight savings time. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, let's see what happens with California. Thank you very much for that,
thanks,
Paul.
Tom.
Good to hear from you. Jim in Poway, California. Hey, Jim.
Poway, California it is, yes. Right down the street from the busiest border crossing in the world.
Oh, my. So,
appreciate your conversation.
Sure.
Just a heads up to you that Florida is, in fact, doing away with daylight savings time starting next year.
Really?
So and I think that'll be a start.
Was this the Florida legislature passed this, or was this a ballot initiative or a governor's decree?
I think that's what happened.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
And, you know, once California does it, you know, as goes California, so goes the United States.
There you go. Makes perfect sense.
Appreciate your show.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you, Jim. Hollis in San Bruno, California. Hey, Hollis, what's on your mind today?
Hey, well, two things. What I was really going to talk about, and in answer to your last caller, the way I read it, Florida is moving to permanent daylight savings time.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, check it out.
Whether it's permanent daylight savings time or permanent no daylight savings time, what I object to is shifting twice a year. It's just like, you know, on the Monday mornings, there's more traffic fatalities. I'm betting that the day after daylight savings time changes, there's more traffic fatalities, too. I mean, it's literally a life and death matter. But
good point. Anyway, what I really called for was to say thank you for bringing up Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations. I actually read it many years ago, and everybody should, because it's a short book and it's an easy read. The point is that what he was talking about was a nation of small producers.
Right.
And that's where the invisible hand works. If you have oligopoly, monopoly, monopsony, any of that, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's where we are now.
And
while I was on hold, I was trying to think of any industry where that didn't apply, and I couldn't do it.
Well, this is what's happened largely since 1982, 83, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and kicked off the mergers and acquisitions mania. And now you've got all these giant companies that really suffer no competitive pressures, industry after industry. You know, the airline industry, you know, what I experienced over the weekend is just another example of it. I mean, it's all over the place. So, yeah, well said, Hollis. And John Maynard Keynes, by the way, also wrote at some length about the importance of small businesses and how Smith's theories could work with small businesses. And I'll see if I can dig that quote up. David Corton shared it with me over the weekend, and I need to track it down. Hollis, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. It's coming up on the bottom of the hour here, coming up on 28 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler wars in the place where despair is not an option. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Another question. Trump, it looks like, only announced the tariff to try to help this guy Rick Saccone in Pennsylvania. Is he going to back away from it when the election's over? Welcome back. This is fascinating. Somebody on Twitter, let me get over there and attribute it to the right person, Rusty Cannon on Twitter, tweeted to me this article from businessinsider.com. Every year, this is pretty amazing. Every year on the Monday after daylight savings time in the spring. Now, the change back in the fall, we get an extra hour of sleep, and so everybody likes that. There doesn't seem to be a problem associated with that. But the one in the spring literally kills. On the Monday of daylight savings time, hospitals nationwide see a 24% increase in heart attacks. By Tuesday, that rate has dropped by 21%. So there's still another 3% increase in heart attacks. But it's like that it's just losing an hour's sleep, basically. In fact, according to the article, the average American loses about 40 minutes of sleep as a consequence of this change. And the author goes on to note that it takes weeks to recover from this. We're prone to make more deadly mistakes on the roads. The researchers estimate that car crashes in the U.S. cost likely 30 extra people their lives over a 9-year period from 2002 to 2011. And also in the week of the springtime week of daylight savings time, we have more injuries at work, more strokes, and even more suicides. So this, and this article says Florida and Massachusetts are starting to lobby to ditch the switch. I think we should just do it nationally. So, and it's not really saving anything as far as we can tell. So, actually, it is daylight savings time. Okay, our performances, yeah. And another person says, too bad you don't take questions from your Twitter feed. What can be addressed before November to repair the damage by the GOP and 45 and Trump to our government? We just need to wake up as many people as possible. I mean, every one of us needs to make part of our personal mission to turn people on to progressive media, get them reading progressive websites, radio and television programming, things like that. Help wake people up. I mean, it's just pretty straightforward stuff. Stephen in Huntsville, Texas. Hey, Stephen, what's on your mind today?
Hey, glad to find you. I have not seen you in decades. You're looking terrific.
Well, thank you, Steve. What's up?
My background is liberal. My grandmother was a suffragette. She was a member of the American-Soviet Friendship Committee throughout all of World War II. MacArthur and Patton, she just told them, you're wrong. The Russians are our friend.
Well, in World War II, they were our friend. They were our allies. They helped us.
Yeah, our allies to a certain
degree. We couldn't have defeated Germany without the help of Russia. It just comes right down to that.
Yeah, and so she always felt vindicated. I mean, she believed through that forever, women's liberation and such. And I just share that with you because my background is much of what you're talking about, and I'm sort of loyal to some of that. My question for you to answer later in the show, perhaps, is why do you call Reagan a neoliberal? I never heard that before. And talking with people like you, it's dialogue, it's rational, it's argument, it's substantive. Some people, like maybe the guys coming out of Berkeley lately, who want to go to violence, they don't have a substance to talk about. Mm-hmm. Okay, I watch your show and you get to that. The real thing I want to understand is this deal about tariffs, and I might agree with you. My father was a union organizer for 10 years of public employees, so I'm steeped in the union thought.
So your question...
My question is, post-World War II, the message of economic interdependence between America and, like, say, China now or Russia, right, to where it makes no sense to go to war with a company or a country that you have so much money invested in, it was supposed to be a peace plan.
Yeah, that was the theory of the European Union. That's why they put the European Union together, because, you know, Europe had just had two insanely bloody wars, World Wars I and II, and they thought, you know, if we have a shared economic future, then, you know, we won't have another war. I don't think that the European Union experiment is going. It's working out really, really well for Germany, but you know. you talk to Greeks or Portuguese or Irish or whatever. Well, the Irish like the EU because it gives them access to the continent. But you talk to a lot of folks in other countries, and they'll tell you that their sense of it is that basically the EU is simply Germany's way of having, you know, one World War II. The euro in particular, you know, going with a single currency. But to your question about Reagan, I define neoliberalism as the belief that markets are better than democracy, essentially, and that marketplaces should be making decisions rather than governments and people, and you know that the power that we traditionally hold on behalf of the people by government, that power should instead reside, quote, in the marketplace. And by in the marketplace, the way it always ends up being played out is by those who control the marketplace, which is the wealthiest and most powerful, the largest corporations. And you know, what's, so the question, a neoliberal question is always, what's best for the big corporations? And, you know, doing away with tariffs was great for big corporations. It's not necessarily great for the United States. You know, all our jobs went overseas, and it's not good for our security, our national security. I mean, you know, the border guard, crossing guards, the ICE guys down in Mexico, the border crossing guys, or the, you know, the border patrol, they're wearing uniforms manufactured in Mexico. I mean, how weird is that, right? So
why is it neoliberal as opposed to neoconservative?
Well, it's using the word liberal in the context of the British use of that word, the European use of that word. In Europe, if you say liberal, what you mean is what we mean as conservative here in the United States, or as corporatist, let's say. And this is the new iteration of 19th century European liberalism. And we're really kind of getting in the weeds here, Stephen. I think the bottom line is that this experiment, this neoliberal experiment that, you know, we really went into in a big way, Thatcher in 78 and Reagan in 80, both the United States and Europe and the UK, has turned out to be a failure. It does, you know, the theory was that we were all rich enough that if we turned everything over to the big corporations and we encouraged transnational corporate activity, that would eliminate the possibility of another world war, number one. And frankly, I don't think that we're even close to that. In fact, I think that we're staring down the barrel potentially of a war with China specifically. They are militarizing at an insanely rapid rate, and the whole conflict around the Spratly Islands and the stuff in the South China Sea is amping up the tensions between China and Japan and South Korea, and now you've got Taiwan, you know, involved in the mix, and it's just, you know, it's and there's the Euripides, no, Thucydides. Anyhow, he's a Greek philosopher. The trap that was named after him, which was that when an emerging economy begins to surpass a long dominant economy, that those countries typically end up at war, that's a very real concern. So those are the things.
I see North Korea as a buffer for Japan, for China.
Yeah,
they
do too.
Nuclear weapons on their border, but they don't get called on it. So I don't think China's really interested in denuclearizing North Korea.
If they were, they would have stopped Kim a long time ago, because without China's support, Kim ceases to exist. North Korea just can't. So North Korea, you know, China's using North Korea as a separator from South Korea. You know, the Korean Peninsula is kind of attached to that part of the continent.
And it's their pseudo-nuclear threat.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, by proxy, you know, from us. But,
yeah,
excellent point. Stephen, I need to move along, but thank you for the call. Good talking with you. Rich in Greenwood, Indiana. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks. When you opened the show, you were talking about trade policy and how tariff represents these benefits. And I was suddenly made to think about modern monetary theory and the value it represents and where it comes from. Both of these things are generated by the structure that creates the market. This is government. This is government direction. So tariffs are created by Washington. The idea of MMT is with the Fed, again, government. And I was thinking about how if both of these things were practiced in the same direction, there'd be this bookended reinforcement, and there'd be this support for the means of production. In other words, that which the workers control.
Right.
And the idea that there has been this purposeful demobilizing and a divide and rule that has been perpetrated by that which we call our governance. I'm reminded of a statement from the Scott Noble tripart plutocracy, and I think it was in Solidarity Forever, which was the second of the three. There's divide et impera, solidarity forever, and then class warfare. Carnegie Steelworks plant manager Jay Gould said, I can always hire half the poor to kill the other half.
Right, right. Yeah, this is the issue of tariffs, of trade policy. The larger, and Rich, thank you for the call. The larger issue here is that we need to have a national conversation about developing a national industrial policy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Just, you know, slapping a tariff on steel to try to help a Republican in Pennsylvania is not going to do it, right? If we need a national comprehensive policy. Okay, welcome back. Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, I was thinking, you know, historically, we, you know, the taxation without representation was really the real problem with tax inequality. Mm-hmm. You had wealthy Americans, you know, going against the king, cutting into their wealth. I would like to upgrade that rally cry for the birth of our country to economics, no economy with no representation. Because, you know, basically, you know, when you have a monopolized inequality, how can one claim to be civilized? Because the DNA of being civilized is cooperation.
You're
not
right.
Exploitation.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say, you know, the Bernie went to Wall Street and said, hey, greed isn't good. But he didn't push the envelope and say the system monopolized greed. So...
Well, I think,
I think we need to go to that level to make people understand that, you know, we're not really democratic. We, you know, we legalize inequality with we're not putting our money where our mouth is.
Well, and the pushback on that, Jesse, or not pushback, but, the thing that you inspired me to think about, shall we say, is that you're saying you can't have a functioning economy or at least a fair economy without representation of the average person and the worker in particular in the economy. In other words, democracy. And there is a form of democracy in the workplace. It's called a union. And by systematically destroying unions, I mean, this was the work of Ronald Reagan's life, was to destroy unions. And he did it, and to a large extent. And now the Supreme Court may finish them off, you know, and in this case that was just... Go ahead.
Can I back on that? When you said the unions is a representation of democracy, how can it be? Because the boss has absolute power.
No, he doesn't, because the union is a democratic institution, and if the union members say, you know, we're not going to go along with what the boss says, they go on strike. And the laws, the Wagner Act, protects their right to go on strike. Prior to 1935, they didn't have that right. So that you know, the laws that defend unionization defend the right of democracy in the workplace. That's my argument.
Well, I challenge that because when the boss has the right to control the money, to shut the job down, the man can't feed his family, That's not democracy.
But I agree with you. But in a state that has not signed on to Taft-Hartley, that has not gone, you know, as a right to work for less state, in a state that is still a union shop state, if the boss says, I'm going to shut this plant down because I don't like what the union's doing, the boss can get fined, can lose his business, might even go to jail under some circumstances. Under the Wagner Act, under the law that protects the right of workers to unionize, there are things you can't do against a union. Now, this is one of the reasons why libertarians like the Kochs hate unions so much, and a lot of big companies hate unions. But this is why, you know, Harry Truman was right to have vetoed Taft-Hartley. I mean, the Republicans passed it over his veto. But anyhow, I get your point, Jesse. Jesse, thank you for the call. It's always good talking with you. I love your comment about the DNA of democracy in our economies. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Lisa in Grants Pass, Oregon. Hey, Lisa, you wanted to talk about tariffs?
Well, hi, Tom. Just real quickly, I want to make a comment also about daylight savings time. My dog, they don't care if we set the clocks ahead to, you know, to or behind to, you know, when it's time to eat, it's time to eat, you know.
Right. Right. And it should be for all of us.
Right. But I just started another business and I'm working on purchasing an orchard that has partly has hemp in it. And I went to a hempcrete workshop, and the fellow who ran it is from New Zealand. And we had to, when we put the walls in Apri City Winery, which is in Grants Pass, in the tasting room, and the hemp and the lime that we mixed had to be imported because it so. And I looked into us putting the hemp in my garage, you know, for my two-car garage. I said, okay, let's start there.
You're talking about growing it?
No, to actually put the hempcrete, you know, take the walls out and put the hempcrete in my garage so that I could use my garage.
Hempcrete? I don't understand what you're talking about.
Well, hempcrete is the mixture of hemp and lime, and you mix it with water, and then you pack it in.
So it's like making concrete, only making it with hemp rather than sand. Is that what you're saying?
Right, but it's actually, it goes into the walls of the house.
Huh.
Okay, and what it does is it insulates. The rats and mice can't get in because it's packed.
Isn't it food for bugs?
Excuse me?
Isn't it food for bugs?
The hempcrete?
Yeah. Yeah, hemp is organic material. I mean, doesn't that make your concrete edible?
Well, actually, no, because it's sealed. I didn't pay for the sealing part of it. I just helped put the hemp in the walls.
Right.
And the termites don't like it.
Huh.
And that was one of the problems I had with my houses in California was termite problems.
Right. Right.
So it cools in the summertime, and it's a very good insulator, and it warms in the wintertime. And it also filters the carbon out of the air, and it mitigates the effects of radiation. There are so many amazing properties to hemp. So when I got a price, when we figured out the price of what it was going to cost, just for my two-car garage, it would be $40,000 because of it has to be imported.
Oh, geez.
Because we can't. You know, because it's so hard to grow it here. And the infrastructure, see, here's what I learned when I was publishing my book. I wanted to publish it on hemp paper. So I went on the internet, and the only hemp paper I could find was in China. So I had to actually buy an entire truckload in order to publish my book. And every time I published orders, I kept thinking, oh, my God, how many trees are going down for this book?
Right.
And when I talked to the printers, I said, can we use the hemp paper? And they said, well, it might clog our machines because our machines are made for virgin pulp from trees.
Sure.
So, and the properties of hemp.
Fascinating. What does this have to do with tariffs, Lisa?
Well, the imports. See, the we have to import the hemp. Now, if we could grow the hemp here, and the, then we could save...
Yeah, it seems like the simple solution to all this is simply to do away with the laws that I think at least one state has already done that. I believe it's North Dakota. I could be wrong, but it's one of those states in that region. Make it legal to grow hemp. I mean, Bob from Tahlequah has been calling about this topic for years into this program, and I agree. Lisa, I need to move along, but thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Jim in Memphis. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm confused about trade. I'm hoping you can help me out.
Sure.
I've always been like you. I've been pretty much supportive of protectionism and tariffs, but I keep hearing these arguments, even from Democrats on TV, I've noticed, who are attacking not just Trump, but Bernie Sanders, accusing him of being on the same side as Trump, that basically if you raise tariffs, you start a trade war. I know this is simplistic, but this is the argument. How do we respond to it? We start a trade war, and you're going to hurt American industry that depends on exports and imports. We're in a global economy. We can't just wall ourselves off. So what is your response to that, that you're going to call it a trade war? You may save some jobs in the
you can call
industry,
it,
but you're going to...
Yeah, the two arguments that are typically made are the one that you just did, that you're going to kick off a trade war, and the other argument that's made is that all of a sudden everything that you buy is going to get more expensive because it's made here in the United States. I would say instead of calling it a trade war, you could call it a re-equalization process. Because, yes, there will be a trade war if you want to call it that. We put a tariff on their goods, they put a tariff on our goods. But what comes out of that is in the best interests of both nations. It's not a war. I mean, applying the renormalization of trade relations between countries so that rather than trade being run by and for the benefit of big transnational corporations, trade is run by and for the benefit of individual nations is, in my opinion, a good thing. And so, again, I hate to agree with Donald Trump, but when he said, I wouldn't mind a trade war, I wouldn't either. It's just that we need to do it smart. There was a time in the United States, when Sam Walton started Walmart, I remember back in the day, we were living in Georgia, one of the very first Walmarts went up outside Atlanta. And the big banner across the front of the store was made, 100% made in the USA. Walmart was started with the idea of selling American-made goods. Find an American-made good in Walmart now. So what happens is, yes, the prices go up, but so do the wages. So, and the wages go up faster than the prices do. Jim, I got to run, but thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.